The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China with our indispensable daily newsletter, website, and growing range of podcasts and videos. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Joining me from stately Goldcorn Manor in the genteel outskirts of Nashville, Tennessee, is a man who was so unable to control his excitement in casting his first ever presidential primary ballot that he had to wear adult diapers to the polls, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, hey, wait, so did you vote early, man?
I voted on, I think the first day was possible.
You know? All right. See, you couldn't contain your excitement.
I'm an immigrant. I'm somebody who hasn't had a lot of democracy in my life, so I'm trying to make up for it. Sadly, I arrive in this country to this state, but what can one do?
You guys vote Super Tuesday like us, right?
Yeah.
All right. I will not inquire as to who you voted for the Democratic race, but I can tell you that I threw mine away because my candidate is already out of the race. Oh, well, dang it. Anyway, enough of that. Beijing's relationship with Venezuela has been fascinating to watch, especially in recent years, as China has looked with conflicting emotions at this resource-rich but economically devastated country and has tried to anticipate Venezuela's political future. For Beijing, Venezuela went from the largest recipient of Chinese loans in the whole world to a basket case that was really fraught with all sorts of political risk. Now, I suspect that I am not the only person interested in China who is guilty of not having really kept up with all the vicissitudes of that relationship, but hopefully today's conversation will catch us all up and offer some really valuable insights. Our guest today is Parsifal de Sola Alvarado. Trained as a telecoms engineer, Parsifal lived in China from 2008 to 2015. He holds master's degrees in East Asian Studies from Columbia and in Chinese Politics and History from SOAS. Since last summer, he has worked in the Foreign Office of Juan Guaido, who, as I think most of our listeners will know, was named president a little over a year ago by the National Assembly in Venezuela, which contested, of course, the re-election of Nicolas Maduro in 2018. Parsifal is now based in Bogota, Colombia, where the foreign minister of the Guaido government actually resides. He set up a China desk there and is pushing now to win Beijing over to the Guaido side. Parsifal, thank you so much for taking the time, and welcome to Seneca.
Thank you very much for having me, Kaiser.
Parsifal, why don't we start with the very basics about where China-Venezuela relations were in terms of perhaps levels of investment, trade volume, and the political relationship back before Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999?
Sure thing. Okay, well, much like in the rest of the region, China's relationship with Latin America in general was pretty much in the, let's say, the back doors of Chinese foreign policy. The commercial relationship was at a minimum. Venezuela and China bilateral commerce was at around $100 million in 1999, so basically insignificant. But it was much. The same thing throughout the rest of the region. The only, let's say, close relationship, political relationship that China had with a country in Latin America was with Cuba, primarily as a, let's say, a legacy of the Cold War. So in 1999, Hugo Chavez wins the election by a landslide, comes into power, and he initiates this transition where we had a long relationship with the United States of promoting, democracy in the region. We were close allies with the United States. And Hugo Chavez began this change where he started getting closer to countries like China, like Russia, countries in the Middle East. And this is where this newfound relationship with Beijing starts taking place in the beginnings of the 2000s. I always like to tell the story about, do you guys remember Qian Hua? He was the director of the China Development Bank. So this whole thing started back in 2004 when Chen was an official visit to Havana, and I got it from an interview that Chen gave Cai Xin back in August last year. You guys should definitely check it out. Very rare interview where he talks about the development of the foreign investments carried out through the bank. And so, well, he talks about this visit that he made in July 2004, where the purpose of his trip was to, hear out the Cuban government about how to proceed with the the expansion of the investments of the bank in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And Chen immediately brings up the name of Hugo Chavez, which Chen was completely unaware of. And I'm paraphrasing here. So Castro describes Hugo Chavez as the Napoleon, the Latin American Napoleon of the 20th century. And he tells him that Chavez was going to change the political and the geopolitical landscape of the region. And this obviously grabs Chen by surprise. He didn't know who Chavez was at the time. And point being, just 5 months later, in December, the same year, Chen was in Caracas signing the first agreements between the Venezuelan government and the Chinese government.
Wow.
So this is where everything, starts snowballing down to where we are today. No, extremely close, but you have to put that into context.
Okay.
Yeah, so between 2007 and 2017, those 10 years, China lent Latin American countries from Mexico all the way down to Argentina, a total of between $145 and $150 billion, out of which, as you said, $67 billion went only to Venezuela. So this gives you an idea. It's almost half of the entire loan portfolio of China to Latin America. So
yeah, number two is Brazil, right? Number two is Brazil, and that was only less than half as much as went to Venezuela, right?
Yeah, around $16 to $17 billion, more or less. So there was this huge difference between the importance that if we measure it in terms of loans that China gave Venezuela in comparison to the rest of the region. In terms of the close relationship that they've developed, Chavez visited China a total of 6 times as president. This is far more than any other Latin American head of state. And Maduro, while in office, has gone 3 times. And he was foreign minister of Chavez for around 2 years. And he also went a couple of times as foreign minister. So, it's the same the other way around. Even Jiang Zemin visited Venezuela, in 99. Countless delegations, Hu Jintao visited, Xi Jinping has gone twice. So, yes, this close relationship was developed with its peak at around 2011-2012. Just 1 year prior to Chavez passing away in late 2012.
Wow.
Possible. During those years, the height of the sort of Chavez coziness boom, the investments and loans that China made, is it right that they were mostly in the extractive industries?
There's one thing, one important thing to point out. There was no investment in Venezuela. This was all loans. Those $67 billion were loans for cash. Oil for cash. This is very important because people tend to mix the two. And this has a bunch of important implications for the Venezuelan government because since it's being described as Let me back up a little bit. In Venezuela, it is described as investment because that way they could bypass Congress. Well, Parliament in the Venezuelan case. So it does all those $67 billion weren't approved by the Venezuelan Parliament, even though back then the entire Parliament was in Chavez's controlled by Chavez's party. But the thing, but in terms of in practical terms, it was actually loans channeled through Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA. So the Venezuelan government was basically compromising the future earnings of the state-owned company in order to pay back Chinese loans. So that had an important, the Venezuelan government stopped receiving the money that was supposed to receive from the sale of oil in the future because it was paying back Chinese loans. So there's a very important distinction between, you know, labeling the Chinese money as investment or as loans.
Right. That makes sense.
And now that we've made that distinction clear, is it then true that these loans were all in the extractive industries and they were all backed up by a promise to pay back in oil, essentially?
Okay, well, not a big part of it was in the extractive industries. We do not have specific numbers due to the lack of transparency. We do not have access to many of the contracts that were signed between the Venezuelan and the Chinese government. But best estimates are that around 60% of the loans were earmarked for the extractive industry, primarily oil. And minerals, rare earths. Venezuela has a very large untapped reserve of rare earths that we still don't know exactly how big they are. But the Chinese are definitely participating in that sector.
Right. I'm curious, first of all, what were popular attitudes toward China like during Chavez's time? Did he consider himself really to be kind of ideologically aligned with China? I mean, besides, of course, the fact that notionally they were both communist, I'm curious because China during, especially during that time, I mean, we're talking about the years of Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, China was not exactly an exemplary practitioner of orthodox Marxism-Leninism, but what was the ideological component and what was popular attitudes all about toward China?
From the Venezuelan side, from the Venezuelan government side, yes, that there was definitely an affinity that they were both leftist governments. Chavez, he praised a lot the communist revolution in China. He was kind of this a promoter of Chinese culture, Chinese political culture in Venezuela. So there was definitely an affinity, and I think Beijing obviously was happy to be endorsed in that way by the Chavez regime.
That makes sense. What about popular ideas toward that? I mean, what did the people think about China during that time?
No, in general, let's say public opinion regarding the Chinese has always been good and generally positive, and it has remained so to this day. It hasn't actually changed much because, given the current crisis scenario in Venezuela, China has taken a backstage role. They're not being blamed in any way for what's, at least I'm talking about at a society level, not in political circles.
Right.
And what about their actual ability, Beijing's actual ability to influence political decision making in Venezuela during the Chavez years? Besides the massive loans, were there other ways that the Communist Party of China helped Chavez? Did they support Venezuela in the UN on any of its diplomatic issues or such like?
No, for sure. The support from the Chinese government has been mostly in countering international criticism about the growing the authoritarian nature. First during Chavez and now during Maduro. So in terms of international support, yes, Beijing has played a role. internally, not so much. I think they've actually have stuck to their rhetoric about non-intervention. It has been mostly how the loans have influenced the political decision-making internally compared to any, let's say, direct involvement of Chinese advisory as an advisor role that it would influence. But no, in general terms, I think in domestic policy has been more how the Venezuelan government used those loans basically to help them stay in power, since Venezuela has been basically left out of international borrowing markets. So it definitely has been financial oxygen for the regime, but the direct influence in political decision making, we haven't seen any evidence of it.
The People's Republic of China, making the world safer autocracy since 1949. That's a really very consistent with a lot of their policies. Well, I mean, Chavez died before Xi Jinping really had his hands firmly on the reins, before he launched the Belt and Road Initiative too. So after 2013, so during Maduro's years in power, was there really a big increase in Chinese investment or trade? And how did maybe Venezuela compare to the rest of the region in terms of its significance for China? I know that we've said the loans really, you know, outmatch anything that was to the rest of the region, but did Venezuela continue to be the most important destination for outbound, lending?
No, we definitely see a change with Xi Jinping, but I think it was more related to the fact that they've been growing impatient with the way Chavez was spending the Chinese funds. There was no accountability whatsoever, and this goes all the way back to 2012. You could go back and look at an article by Kejo Vias in the Wall Street Journal back in 2012, where some conversations leaked from the Chinese embassy in Caracas, where they were basically fed up with the way that the Sino-Venezuelan Fund had been handled. And that was exactly the last election of Hugo Chavez. And to give you an idea, the Venezuelan fund the Sino-Venezuelan fund at the time had around $20 billion, and $8 billion of those disappeared basically out of thin air with no paper trail.
Wow.
And the Chinese obviously complained about where the money had gone. This was back in 2012. So I think that was like the beginning of the end of that honeymoon period between both administrations.
You said 8 billion out of 20 billion had disappeared.
Yeah.
That's some epic level kleptocracy there. That's amazing.
So, and I think that 2011, 2012, and especially after Chavez died, because Maduro he doesn't have the persona that Chavez had. Venezuela lost a big part of its political influence in the region. And I think that goes hand in hand with China's loss of interest in Venezuela.
I've got to say, it's difficult not to think, you know, a little bit, I told you so. I mean, you give an economically illiterate thug a boatload of free money and, you know, you wonder why this happens. But I don't know. I guess the Communist Party's taken a little while to kind of understand the real world, and now they're learning fast.
Definitely, yeah, I completely agree.
Possible, on a slightly different topic, I believe there's a substantial ethnically Chinese population in Venezuela, maybe as much as 500,000, although most of them came from Guangdong before the founding of the People's Republic. Is that correct, and do they form any kind of political force in Venezuela?
Good question.
At its peak, before Chavez, Venezuela already had an important Chinese diaspora in the country. It was around 200, best estimates are that around 200,000 Chinese lived in Venezuela by the late 1990s. And this skyrocketed to around 600,000 at its peak in 2011, 2012.
Wow.
So you had two generations of Chinese. You had a lot of lower income Chinese from the south, especially from Guangdong province, as you mentioned, Jeremy. And then you had this second wave that started arriving in the country around 2005, 2006, with the opening of relationship between the both countries, where a new, like younger professional generation started of mostly people related to, well, Huawei, ZTE, CNPC, so Chinese companies that started operating in Venezuela. So there was an influx of professional Chinese that came into the country on that second half of the last decade.
I can't imagine that many of them must have stuck around once the economy started to implode, though. And then, you know, with hyperinflation, you know, over 2,300% inflation rate. What's happened to that second wave of Chinese in the last few years?
And no, most of them left, not to say all of them, but according to our best estimates, around 400,000 of them left. So there's we went back to the 200,000 prior to Chavez. So no, yeah, they joined the Venezuelan diaspora in leaving the country, and it's kind of funny because a lot of them actually. Went to other Latin American countries. We still have no data, no statistics on this, but just last year in November, I was in Santiago de Chile, and it turns out that the new Chinese restaurants being opened were these Venezuelan Chinese food restaurants owned by, you know, the Chinese community that left Caracas. And they were hiring Venezuelans in order to help them. So it's an interesting, you know, social aspect that they didn't actually go back to China, and they started moving to other Latin American countries.
Oh, fantastic.
Percival, China was in the process of building what would have been South America's first high-speed rail system, but abandoned the project. Do you know when that project got started and when and why construction stopped?
Okay, well, first of all, construction, if we talk in practical terms, construction actually didn't start. It was very, very basic. They set up these towns of Chinese workers, and they started setting up the different bases for the development of the supposed first high-speed rail of the region. Again, it's very hard to have an idea of the level of investment or the level of money that went into the project. It could go. Our estimates are between $4 billion and $7 billion. So, there's a huge a window there. But the point being, not even one station. I'm talking. They didn't even lay down the tracks. We have interviews from Chinese workers at the time that they told us that I'm talking about a bit not construction workers, but at the level of the engineering circle of the project, and they were amazed of the level of corruption, the level of lack of accountability from local authorities. Because I remember this one guy that was amazed that they set up the toilets, the bathrooms for the workers, and the next day they were gone.
Ah, oh my God.
Yeah, they. I think they really had no idea what they were getting themselves into, and the supposed first bullet train ended up in ruins. And you could actually go into, if you check up in Reuters, there's photographs of the remains of what would have been the rail line.
What was the route supposed to be, from where to where?
It was supposed to be around, if I'm not mistaken, around 1,000 kilometers long. So Venezuela doesn't have a rail system. Okay, so the train line was supposed to go across the country east to west, and then have some branches along the Venezuelan central plains. But it was supposed to be between 1,000 and 1,200 kilometers in length.
So, Percival, am I understanding you correctly that a problem, or maybe the major problem, seems to be that while the Chinese were trying to build this thing, the local authorities or local criminals were just stealing all the stuff, so they were unable to make progress. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's,
I mean,
that's,
I assume there must be other reasons too, including perhaps the Chinese tendency to build a gate and a, you know, the front door of a project, but, you know, wait until the rest of the money comes through to actually follow through. That may have had something to do with it too, but...
No, there were both things were present. Another important aspect of the loans is that a big part of them was actually in renminbi. It was not in U.S. dollars. So obviously, where can you spend the renminbi back in China? So they guaranteed the participation of Chinese companies in the construction projects, and. So there were a lot of intermediaries that were supposed to, let's say, connect the Venezuelan projects to Chinese companies. So that lent itself to a lot of corruption as well, a lot of overpricing in the materials and in the contracts per se. And then we would have to there's the whole thing about the currency exchange control in Venezuela that is still present to this day, that you had a subsidized U.S. dollar that you if you had access to them through government, they would be around, like, they fluctuated between 3 to 5 times below the, let's say, the black market, the real value of the U.S. dollar. So that, in conjunction with the Chinese loans, you could, I'll give you an example. You could charge $1 million for a specific set of products, but if you exchanged that at the local controlled rate, it would have been much 3 or 4 times less, and someone would eventually go to the black market and sell it and win, you know, $500,000-$600,000 for just having access to subsidized U.S. dollars in the Venezuela exchange system.
It's a witch's brew of sort of almost like parody Banana Republic problems, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And this is one of the main reasons of the crisis that we suffer today, that this was only possible because of this, of the commodity boom. Just imagine this. Prior to Chavez, the 44 decades of a democracy in Venezuela, which started in the 1950s, the average oil barrel was $9 per barrel. Oh, in over 4 decades. And during Chavez's 13 years in office, it was 92, 93. So imagine the amount of money that came into the country. We had a high on petrodollars that, permitted this kind of, as you said, this banana republic with no rule of law where everyone was allowed to take advantage of this influx of petrodollars facilitated by the commodity boom.
Well, I think that's an excellent, easy explanation for how things are the way they are. But I've also heard it suggested that China had some fault in this. There was a Financial Times op-ed from about 5 years ago that basically made that case. Do you agree that China, I think the way that they put it in an op-ed was that China supplied the rope with which the Venezuelan economy then hanged itself?
I think that there's definitely a lot of that. Talking about going back to the example I gave you about the $8 billion that disappeared from the fund, those were used basically for Chavez's reelection. So incrementing social expenditure, subsidizing food, subsidizing services, and that's basically where it went throughout the 2012. So yes, it allowed Venezuela to continue spending as if the, I think there actually one, maybe we're talking about the same article in FT.
Yeah, by Ricardo Hausmann. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That Venezuela was spending as if the barrel was at 190 when it was already starting to depreciate.
Huh. What was the reaction of the Chinese policy banks, CDB and Exim Bank, once the Venezuelan economy started to collapse? Did they demand that Maduro settle up, or were they willing to restructure, or did they write some of them off?
No, well, there was in 2004, 2014, the CBD actually gave an extension of 2 years with a payment of interest. So this, well, gave some leeway to the Venezuelan government to, well, basically stay afloat financially. So DAPAC actually tried to help the Maduro regime stay afloat, but without extending new loans. There's only been two new ones, I think. The last one was in 2017.
Yeah, that's right.
For $2 billion. And there was actually one in 2018 when Maduro visited Beijing in September that year, that we actually have no evidence that there was any exchange of hard currency. Last year, there was some like Chinese jumbo planes that arrived in Caracas with medicine, food, basic supplies. But in terms of hard currency, there's no evidence that the money made it to the Venezuelan Central Bank. So that last loan that Maduro talked about back in 2018, in 2018, there's no evidence that there was any new cash involved.
So Parsifal, I want to get to this, what I think is sort of the heart of what I think is most interesting that's happening right now, which is China's strategy in hedging between Maduro and Juan Guaido. Can you first talk about how Beijing reacted to the events of January 2019? I mean, had they already actually been in contact with anyone in the opposition to Maduro? And because before Guaido became the focus of, you know, the opposition, you had Enrique Capriles, who was this two-time opposition presidential candidate who's known for being quite vocally critical about Chavez and Maduro and their ties to China. But so has he changed his tune? How is that side, your side, how have they been courting Beijing, and to what effect?
Okay, so the Chinese appraisement of the opposition has actually been pretty interesting. So Chavez, the Chavez party, had control of parliament for around 15 years. And back in 2017, the opposition took control of parliament. It was the first elections that the opposition wins in over a decade. And right after the electoral win of the opposition, Beijing invited, obviously through an NGO, it was not an official invite. They invited the leaders of parliament to Beijing for around a week. And that included the current Venezuelan foreign minister, Julio Borges. He was a member of parliament at the time. So they were actually, the main message of it, they didn't go into specific policies. They were just courting the Venezuelan opposition and letting them know that China wasn't going away. It was not a threat, but it was basically, look, it won't be easy to get rid of us. That was the main message of that gathering back in 2017. It was very courteous, of course, but it was it kind of exemplifies the skepticism, Beijing's skepticism towards the opposition and its close relationship with Washington.
Okay, well, what about the opposition itself in its attitude toward Beijing? Has its tune shifted from maybe more critical to less critical, or are they still keeping that sort of level of criticism going?
No, actually, the Venezuelan opposition has been pretty open about engaging with Beijing. They haven't, there hasn't been any antagonism in the relationship. Actually, if there was Juan Guaido, he penned an article in Bloomberg back in April where he, is sending a message to Beijing talking about that we want, that the Venezuelan interim government wants to engage. They want to talk about the future relationship. They want to talk about, Chinese loans. So I think it's more an, the main message is that we, as in the interim government, are the antidote to, well, the Chinese frustrations in Venezuela. It's like, if they want rule of law, if they want economic stability, if they want political stability, a change of government through democratic means is the only way to actually achieve that. Yeah, and let me add one thing, which is very interesting about how the Chinese reacted in February when Guaido was pronounced interim president. Actually, Chinese operations, with information from sources inside Venezuela, that Chinese operations, especially in the extractive sectors, stopped operations. Like the main Chinese companies in Venezuela stopped operations for over a month. We gathered this from journalistic work that been carrying out in Venezuela, that they didn't know how to react to what was going on. So they say it, they basically were hedging. Let's say, put this, my appreciation is that they wanted to, you know, lay low, see how things eventually evolved. And if Guaido were to come up on top, then they would, you know, basically shift their communication to the new government. After a month, they restarted everything. So everything went back to quote unquote normal.
I was just going to say, Parsifal, in terms of their reaction, what do you think it's guided by? I'm asking specifically about how much expertise Beijing has on Latin American affairs. I know, you know, many people would probably be surprised to know how many Chinese experts the government has working on Africa, you know, either directly for the government or in some kind of think tank associated with an academic institution or another government organization. You know, many of these people I know in Africa are trained in local languages, even minority languages, you know, like Afrikaans and Xhosa. So do you know about the Chinese government's expertise in South America, Latin America? How well informed are they?
I think nowadays they've actually learned a lot, precisely because of their experience in Venezuela. In terms of the amount of Chinese expats, professional expats in the political sphere, China's approach in Latin America has been very top-down. So it has been more about engaging with the decision-making community in the different countries more than a bottom-up, let's say, where their knowledge came from Chinese companies operating in the region. They have actually... especially in the last 5-6 years, the ambassadors that they have appointed in the region have at least a decade or two of expertise in Latin American politics. They all speak Spanish, so there's been a professionalization of the diplomatic workforce, Chinese diplomatic workforce in the region.
Fascinating. So the op-ed piece in the FT that we were just talking about, it was interesting that this piece was written, as you said, by Ricardo Hausmann. As it happens, that's the same man that the Juan Guaido government appointed to be governor for Venezuela of the IADB, the Inter-American Development Bank. But China did not grant a visa for Ricardo Hausmann to visit China to take part. You have a very interesting take on this, I understand. It's not maybe as pessimistic as one might conclude just knowing that Hausmann's visa had been denied. What's going on here?
Okay, so, let's go back to that event. That was supposed to be the 10th anniversary of China joining the IADB. Right. They had been preparing this for months. It was going to be this huge event in Guangdong. And, they had invited... people from the different governments in Latin America, a lot of people from the business community. So yeah, this was going to be one of those pompous Chinese events. And then Venezuela gets in the middle of the way. As you rightly mentioned, Ricardo Hausmann was appointed by the interim presidency as the representative at the IADB. When applying for a visa to attend the event, it was denied by the Chinese government under the argument that they were not going to get involved in the Venezuelan internal affairs, that the right. Maduro regime had its own appointment, so that this was something that should have been internally resolved and then decided who was going to go. The interesting thing about the reaction of the Chinese side was that this must have been a huge lose face scenario for them in China, just canceling the event because of one participant. And the reaction, at least publicly, was that that this wasn't a setback, that the event would be rescheduled. They didn't blame anyone, even though there was the decision to push, let's say, the pronouncement of Hausmann was backed by the U.S. And still there wasn't any, scapegoating or blaming the United States for what was going on, which it tells you a lot about Chinese position vis-a-vis the Maduro regime. They didn't vouch for Maduro's appointed person at the IADB. They simply said, let's carry on the event. Neither Hausmann nor Maduro's appointee would attend the event, and we can carry on. So that that's not a strong supporter of Maduro. It was just, stay, don't get in the way of our event.
It's one of those the dog that didn't bark kind of things. That's very interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. And well, afterwards, the thing is, we know for a fact that Hausmann is perceived by Beijing as a very critical figure of the Chinese government. So obviously that played into the whole, denying the visa and the whole IADB issue.
Parsifal, tell us what you're up to now. I understand you've helped launch the Andre Bello China Latin America Research Foundation. What is that foundation's purpose?
Thank you for asking, Jeremy. So the foundation was founded back in December. So we are a very young organization, and the purpose of the foundation is to document the last 20 years of Chinese actions in Venezuela. So why do this? Well, two reasons. First, China has been for the last 5-6 years trying to stay as far away from the Venezuelan issue. I've been tracking Chinese coverage about Venezuela in official media and Zhongguo Ribao or Zhongguo Shidai, and the Venezuelan case has been basically banned from Chinese official media. If you try looking for pronouncements from the Foreign Affairs Office, from MOFCON, Venezuela basically disappeared. And then you have to compare that with, going back to 2008, 2009, I remember perfectly riding taxis in Beijing and the shifu talking about how great Chavez was. And I listened to Chavez in the Chinese radio, on the Chinese radio, at least 4 or 5 times, talking about how great China was. So this was the level of Venezuela was this example of Chinese leadership abroad, and they used it both domestically and internationally. So when you see the contrast, it's actually very telling, the fact that they've tried to stay as far away as possible, basically because they don't want to be blamed for the largest humanitarian crisis the region has seen since its independence days. So what we want to do is we actually want to bring them again into the fold, and not to blame them for what's going on in Venezuela, because the Chinese actually have also been victims of the whole crumbling of the Venezuelan institutions and the high levels of corruption. And the thing is, they have nothing to show for after $67 billion. And that is that, if you compare that with the whole rhetoric about the Belt and Road Initiative, about promoting
the win-win.
The whole win-win scenario. They within the Venezuelan context, the BRI image falls apart. So what we want to do by recollecting all this information is to open up an informed dialogue with people, with the Chinese government, or with people close to the Chinese government, with academics, with journalists, in order to learn from what happened in Venezuela. How not to do things. So what China could have done better to have a higher level of accountability in terms of how the money was invested, learning about the importance about supporting local institutions, about fomenting the rule of law, because there's no data and no numbers on this. Basically, because the whole China-Venezuela relationship was carried out behind doors, under the table. There's no access to the contracts. There's very little numbers in terms of, how the Chinese community perceived this new era of China-Venezuela relations, how the Venezuela community perceived them. So having all that data about the most important relationship China had in the region throughout the 2000s, I think it's going to be a letter of caution for the rest of Latin American countries, but it will also help the Chinese understand why they were so wrong in terms of going all in Venezuela. So that would be the reason for, documenting what has happened with the Chinese in Venezuela throughout the last two decades.
So, Parsifal, you were recently in Washington to meet with people interested in the work that your foundation is doing. I'm curious, while you were there, did you get a sense that China's position in Venezuela and in Latin America more generally is well understood by the policy community in D.C.? And then I think after that, you went down to Chile, to Santiago, and maybe you could compare. I mean, is China well understood by the Latin American policy community? Maybe you could compare and contrast a bit.
There's definitely a big difference between both approaches. My impression from the meetings I held in D.C. was that there's a big interest from the current administration in knowing about China's involvement in the region. So the interest is there, but in terms of making that, translating that interest into action, I think there's no framework or ideas on how to do so. So yes, there's the interest, but they're going against China's involvement in the region.
And right. Right.
This brings me to my
what a surprise.
Yeah, in Chile, this was around like 2-3 months ago. Where Pompeo was made a visit, an official visit to Santiago, and he was basically lecturing the Chilean government about the dangers of dealing with China and Huawei, and how the narrative goes.
I sure do.
Yeah, and actually, there was a pronouncement from the Chinese embassy in Santiago, and there was actually a response from the Chilean Foreign Affairs Office telling Pompeo that Chile will make its own decisions in terms of its foreign policy. So you can see this push by Washington to argue in Latin America, two Latin American governments not to engage with China.
Well, that is another topic that we can take on another time. I think that would be a fascinating one. We would love to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for giving us your valuable perspectives on this. I'm really eager to learn more. So looking forward to talking to you when you're in a proper foreign ministry office in Caracas under happier circumstances, I hope.
Hopefully.
Let's move on now to recommendations. But first, I do want to remind everyone that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. A lot of people ask me what they can do to support the show, and I always tell them they should just subscribe to SupChina Access. Just $88 a year, and you get this fabulous daily email newsletter that is just a treasure trove of links to pieces you should be reading if you want to stay on top of all that's happening in China, courtesy of my friend Mr. Goldcorn and his crack team. And before we get to recommendations, a quick message from one of our sponsors. If you are looking for a challenging summer of significant Chinese language gains and ways to meaningfully connect with Chinese culture, you should look at CET academic programs. CET's China-based Chinese language programs are moving online for summer 2020, so you can spend this at-home summer building your critical language skills alongside a team of dedicated teachers, motivated peers, and tried-and-true intensive Chinese language curriculum.
Through small group and daily one-on-one classes with CET's experienced Chinese language instructors, you will be able to make significant language jumps, gain a better understanding of Chinese culture and society, and have multiple opportunities to interact with Chinese culture and engage with locals from all over China. Applications for this summer are due May 15th. Visit cetacademicprograms.com/virtual for more information.
Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, you want to start us off?
Yeah, sure. I've got one is for what I'm going to call medical Twitter. In the time of...
there's a medical Twitter.
Medical Twitter. doctors, virologists, and epidemiologists, and science journalists on Twitter are proving to be one of the best sources of information about COVID-19. Self-correcting, because people immediately jump down other people's throats if they get something wrong. And if you follow the right people, it's a very good way to get some of the latest data and information and also thinking on this pandemic. I will post a Twitter list.
Is there a list?
I'll make a list.
Great, great.
I'm going to make a list before this podcast is published and include the link in the description of this podcast.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. That'll be super useful. Thank you.
So let's call it COVID-19 medical Twitter. That is my recommendation.
Okay. All right. Parsifal, what do you have for us?
Okay. I'm going to go for a couple of oldies. The people that are interested in a little bit, Spanish readers and interested in a little bit about Venezuelan political history that could give you an idea of the development of democracy in the region. I would recommend this novel by Francisco Zuniaga called, name in Spanish is El Pasajero de Truman. Mm-hmm. So it's Truman's Passenger. And the name comes from, the story goes that about this Venezuelan political figure that was very close to Truman. They developed this close relationship along the years. And actually, Truman, when this person got very sick, he sent the equivalent of a Air Force One at the time to Venezuela to pick him up to have a medical treatment in the U.S. And the whole book is fascinating, and it talks about the development of democracy in Venezuela back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Oh, wow. Sounds great.
On a second note, also a bit old, but maybe you guys are familiar with it. The Man Who Loved China by Simon Winchester.
Oh, yeah. All about Joseph Needham. Yeah.
Exactly. That I loved that book. That was actually I was reading that book traveling through on train through Gansu province, and I went to the Mogao Ku and was reading about the book, so that it made a big impact on me at the time.
I really love me some Simon Winchester. I think he's just a great writer. I know he comes in for a lot of criticism, but I really enjoy him. I find that his book on the 1906 earthquake is really great. His book on the Pacific is really great. I've really quite liked him. Everything of his that I've read, I've really liked. Thanks. Those are great recommendations. I'm also going to go with a book. I want to recommend the book Say Nothing, which is a true story about a murder that takes place during the Troubles in Ireland by Patrick Radden Keefe, who many of you probably know from The New Yorker. This was a recommendation that a journalist friend of mine from Australia named Kate Lamb made. I only started it this weekend, but it is just really gripping. I got it on audiobook. The narrator's accent is definitely enough to just keep me enthralled with this piece of nonfiction crime, the politics of the Troubles or something I don't know super well. And it's been a good eye opener for me there. Great. Hey, Parsifal, thank you one more time. That was a wonderful, I think, very educational conversation. Jeremy, I feel edified. You?
Yes, I do. Edified.
Excellent. Well, that's what we aim to edify. So Parsifal, I hope we can have you on again soon.
Sure thing. Well, thank you very much to you both. It's been my pleasure.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at @subchinanews. And make sure to check out all the other podcasts in the expanding Seneca network. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows coming soon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.